And welcome once again, listeners, to Season 6 of Food Conversations. Before we begin, once again, we acknowledge that we are living and working on lands that belong to the Shkwepmik people and essentially have been stolen from them in the past by our ancestors. And we have to keep thinking about that and ways to solve that thorny issue as we go along. All of us have that responsibility. Now, today in the studio, we have someone who is a volunteer par excellence. In fact, it's become kind of a career since she moved to Salmon Arm. After a life working in various businesses of one sort and another, Valerie Semenyuk came to Salmon Arm a number of years ago as she retired from her work life and plunged into volunteer work, which has been a modus operandi for her ever since then. And we're just delighted to have this arch volunteer on our show today. Welcome, Valerie.
Thank you.
Now, I'm going to do one thing before we start talking about some of the more seminal parts of your life, and that is the way your name is spelt. And we know that there's a history, but it's been lost in the sands of time, I understand.
Yes, it has. My mother gave me that name when I was born, and I've never looked into really what it is or how it came about.
She had some interests that might have explained it.
Yes, she believed in numerology, and I believe that's where the spelling of my name came from, yes.
Well, it's a wonderful spelling.
Thank you.
You look at it and you say, I will never forget this person.
People always say, I can't remember how to spell your name, but I know it's different.
Yes, exactly, and it's Valerie.
Yes.
Thank heavens. V-A-H-L-L-E-R-I. That's a name to conjure by. I don't know much about numerology. I know about the discipline, but I don't know where you'd get those letters and put them together in that way. But it's a wonderful, wonderful little esotericism about one's own life. Now, you were not from here originally. You moved here when you retired and after your husband had passed away. Before that, you had a very large chunk of your life on the other side of the Rockies. Why don't you start where you started in your life, what kind of family circle you had around you when you were growing up?
Well, I was born in Calgary, Alberta, and my parents were working parents. I had grandparents who had been farmers and spent a great deal of time as a child on the farm in a smaller community.
And what did you do on the farm? Have fun?
Yes, it was great. Rode in the combine and on the swather and made a lot of grief for my grandfather.
Really? Well, he probably enjoyed the grief.
He did. And as did we.
Yes.
And I learned to really love the smaller town as well. I think that's partly what drew me to Salmon Arm is I just love the simplicity of a small town. Calgary is a very large center, and with millions of people. When I was a child growing up there, there was about 170,000 people there.
Wow.
So, yeah, I'm very old.
Well, it was very small. Valerie, if you were characterizing the difference between a small community and a large community, what are the things that make the small community a different kind of place?
I think the fact that people are so caring and so giving. I am amazed by this small community and the large hearts that people have who live here. They're very giving in food, in help, in financial assistance. Anytime we need anything, we always seem to end up getting it. I think part of that's through prayer, but the people respond very well in this community to any kind of need, and I'm very surprised because it is such a generous community.
Now, I'm going to help listeners understand why you're on Food Conversations, and that is because you are the manager at Second Harvest. Full name, Second Harvest Food Bank, but Second Harvest, I think it's a much more colorful and evocative name than Food Bank, which you have to think, you know, deposits and withdrawals and stuff like that. And we're going to talk about that later, about your role in the food bank, as in the Second Harvest, rather, and what you have done around that, because that's just a centerpiece, but there's other things to do with your life and your volunteer work that also play a role in that. Your mom and your dad had fairly standard work. Your mother was a hairdresser for a very long time. She had her own business.
Yes.
So you saw your mother being an independent business operator in a days when this wasn't always what families tolerated.
No, that's correct. And often I would help her and learned a lot about social skills and how to deal with people. Also, just wanted to be busy doing something, had to be busy all the time.
And she was running this hairdressing salon on her own. This was not sort of an accessory to other, your husband's work. Your husband, your father, rather, was a builder.
My father was in insurance.
Okay. Sorry, I'm one generation out of date. Yes, he was in insurance, and he did that also for a long time.
Yes.
Your mother, I think you said, was 60 years in that, in that line of work.
Yes, she was.
Your father, how many years did he match your mother with?
He passed away, actually, at 52, so he certainly didn't have a long time in his career. But due to health issues, he did pass when he was not very old.
And what was it like having two working parents? I think if I recall correctly, the gap was filled by grandparents, if there was ever one.
Yes.
Having two working parents working in different fields, did this, I mean, fields of endeavor, not fields in the ground. Your grandparents ended up at some level playing a very significant role in your life. You spent time with, especially with your grandfather on the farm.
Yes. Every summer when school was out, we would 2 days later get on a train and go to Medicine Hat. And from there, we would go to a tiny little town called Snipe Lake, Saskatchewan, where my grandfather's 12 brothers and sisters all farmed.
And all in the same area?
More or less the same area.
Good Lord. Yeah. What a massive and congenial extended family.
Well, he was the eldest. And the way the family worked was when one got married and then the next one got married, they all went out and helped them build a house and get their farm started. So they did that pretty much for all of the members, the male members anyway, of the family.
Kind of like familial Hutterites.
Yes. Yeah. And they were of German descent, so I think they came by that honestly. But it really instilled in me helping people. I mean, whether they're relatives or whether they're people who need help in the community, it was always working together, very few people doing things on their own.
And the other thing was there were people working not to make money, to make a profit, but to be helpful to other people that they cared about.
Yes, yes, for sure. And that was the way they all got their farms going and had a home. And so they helped each other out all the time, which really taught me to share and to want to help others as well.
And to not look at the bottom line all the time.
No.
Just to look at doing the job that you felt was useful to other people. You yourself worked for many years in a number of industries in Calgary. One was a firm that was engaged in building houses.
Yes.
So we caught up to the house building part.
Yes. I worked for New West Development Corporation for about 10 years. And at the same time, my husband was working for Engineered Homes. So house building was the very prominent part of our life in those days.
So you and he ended up working together in certain ways.
And then he went off on his own and started his own company. So I was still very connected to construction, but I went and moved on to a family-owned group of businesses called the Mannix family, or now they're called the Loram Group of Companies. Mm. And
much bigger?
Oh, yes. They have companies all over the world and are still privately owned. They're a significant family in Canada and have a significant contribution to make to communities all over Canada and other parts of the world.
And how do they do that? What is the operating principle behind Mannix?
Giving back to the community. They were a very large, successful company. And one of the things that they did was put a percentage of their earnings back into a company started in memory of their parents, the Carthy Foundation. And I had worked in the Carthy Foundation for a number of years. One of the things that they did on their 100th anniversary was they took a significant amount of money and went back to every community that they had built in or worked in, and especially in BC and Alberta and down east, and gave them a portion of money for a project of their choosing in each center. So part of my job was to work with the people who were stating what their significant projects would be and going from there and ensuring that the funding was made.
So you were very centrally involved with this redistribution
process.
Yes. What was that like? You must have seen a lot of smiling faces.
Yes, we did. It was a bit different than it is here in BC. Working in Alberta, it's a little bit different how business is done there. But yes, we had a lot of wonderful projects that we completed in small towns. It might have been a hockey arena. It might have been a community center. Things that smaller towns, like very tiny towns, needed. And so they had a significant
like
amount
Lake.
Of money to work with, and they got to choose the project. So
I'm just wondering how it felt to be part of something that also resonated with your own experience within your own family, with your grandfather's generation and the kind of interactions.
Well, to me, that seemed very natural to do that.
Yes.
And I was very pleased with the family when they decided to start the foundation and put a significant amount of money into it. The way that foundation works is the people write in for donations, and then we assess them and then send them a donation. And we have worked off of an endowment fund, and so any interest off of the endowment fund is what we distributed back to the community.
Just remind listeners that I'm speaking with Valerie Semenyuk, who's the manager for Second Harvest, and we're talking about that role, but also about a life that led to volunteerism in a very natural kind of way. We're going to be talking about Second Harvest in more detail in a moment, but my sense is that moving here, your husband had died, unfortunately, moving here was sort of a transition in a number of different ways. Moving back to a small town, no longer having the imperative of work in a 9-to-5 sort of job, even though there was, as you just described, some wonderful extenuating circumstances which touched you then, as they had when you saw your relatives building barns for each other. But you came to Salmon Arm to retire and to start a kind of a new chapter. Did you have that feeling at the time that that's what you were doing?
I did. Part of the reason that I came to Salmon Arm was the weather. I was looking for a much milder climate. And again, a smaller center. I had been helping my daughter with her children in central Alberta, and had been there for 5 or 6 years while her children were very tiny. And when they got old enough...
You were the grandmother now.
That's right. When they were old enough to drive, then I made a decision to come to a warmer climate.
You can manage on your own now.
Yes, for sure.
What was it like becoming a grandmother yourself?
I think being a grandmother was the greatest gift I was ever given.
Listeners, you heard that on this station. The greatest gift. I would agree with you 100%, having had good relationships with my grandparents.
Yes.
But I'm glad you made that statement.
Yeah.
Now, explain, compare and contrast grandmotherliness versus, say, being a parent.
With your children, you're always worrying about their health, their well-being, their welfare, and feeding them, clothing them, and of course working. And we were very involved with our children. We worked very hard to keep them busy in sports so that they didn't have time to get into trouble.
Shenanigans.
And so it just seemed quite natural when we became grandparents that we would just fall right into that with the little ones. I have four grandsons and a granddaughter, and the boys have had a very big impact on my life, and I have to honestly say, had it not been for my grandchildren, I don't know how I would have got through the passing of my husband.
What did they do, and how did they feed back to you the love and attention that you had given to them?
Well, I was a household member in their home for a number of years when they were quite small, before they started school, and we'd do all kinds of wonderful things. To me, being a grandparent was stepping outside of the box. So we'd do movie night in Grandma's place, which was my bedroom, a king-size bed with three boys. And we'd eat popcorn and drink pop and chocolate, and then we'd slowly all fall asleep. And my daughter was very kind and never interfered or said they can't do that.
She did not feel you were leading them astray.
That's right. And even now, at the ages of 18 and 20 and 23, the ones that are still at home say, we'll be back from our dates at midnight, Grandma, and then it's movie time. So that was a time that we spent together, and I really, really appreciate that. It was certainly an opportunity to see them grow up and try to help them and instill good morals, good behavior, good manners. I think grandparenting, as I said, is a gift. And I know I appreciated my grandparents so much. And my husband's parents were very good grandparents to our children. So it just seemed natural to do that.
Well, I think that's a wonderful thing to do naturally. You came and you also were looking around for some project, some enterprise that you could put your energy into, especially a quality that you described in your workplace, and that was being very organized.
Yes.
Because over the years you had developed the ability to not only be a good grandmother, but also to be a good organizer and a good person for keeping track of details and structural and activity details. Was that something that you would consider one of your gifts, that you had really that part of yourself?
Very definitely. I have to know everything about every project that I go into. I have to understand how it works. I have to understand every little part of it so that I can clearly assess what's required or what we need to do. Where do we need to...
Is that something you did with your grandchildren, too? You sort of knew all about them. You knew the subtleties of their characters. You knew all of their relationships.
Yes. I think, too, working in corporate business, you have to be very good at what you're doing. And so you really go the extra mile to understand projects very clearly so that you have the answers when called upon to give an opinion.
Did you get the feeling that your employers both understood, you know, the two long-term employers you had, understood and valued that quality in particular?
I believe so, because the projects that I was being given always were very detail-oriented with many moving parts. In 1988, I ran our company's Olympic project. And that was a $1.2 million project where we brought 3,500 of our business associates from around the world to Calgary for the Olympics. And I had a wonderful team I worked with to put that all together. But there were, again, many, many moving parts. So that was really, that's really who I am, a very detailed person. I can work with many moving parts as long as I know the whole picture.
Including one's own moving parts, which, of course, don't always move as well as they once did.
No, that's right.
But obviously you'd develop patterns within your own family, a long tradition, the tradition of helping one another, and then being a very active grandmother for your grandchildren, there is that side of it as well. And you mentioned working with teams of people and how important it is to have a sense of mutual shared responsibility. That how did you manage that in terms of allowing people to have some initiatives, you know, to come up with good ideas, but also keeping them sort of on side with respect to what the team was doing?
Well, I my own personal management style is one of assessing the project, discussion as to what the project is, what the requirements are, what the end result should be, and then I like to empower people to do the job. I try not to interfere too much unless I see it going off the rails, but if you empower people, it allows them to feel a part of something and to be able to contribute. And I think that's a really important thing for people who, whether they're volunteering or working, they need to feel part of something, something that's important.
Manager grandmother. Manager yes. grandmother style. I'm just thinking of phrases that you were talking to describe this kind of approach, that it's with small children, you don't shape their characters. They have characters already. You just try and keep them from turning their character traits into something problematic.
Yes.
But one of the way to do it is to celebrate and have fun together. When you left the Mannix family business, what was that like? They must have said, oh, darn, she's going to retire now.
Well, they're an incredibly generous family, and I always enjoyed working with them. There were always challenges. Very seldomly were things done normally. It was always a challenge because it was a private family, and I had never worked for a private family before at that level. So, again,
was that because the family had to deal with itself at times?
Yes, families? And we also got involved with their children, bringing them along through the Carthy Foundation into the family business. So we were working. I was working with children at that time as well, but it was a very important company in Canada and in Alberta particularly, and so we were always challenged. And again, here's the job. This is what we need. And I just would say, okay, get out of the way. Here I come.
Well, I think when they saw you coming, they would probably be quite happy most of the time. When you came to Salmon Arm, what was the first role that you thought of putting your energies into, like a formal role?
I wanted to be busy, first of all, because I had been busy for my entire life. I'm not a person to just sort of sit on the Chesterfield and watch television. So I wanted to be busy.
You could eat popcorn on your bed with your grandchildren, but that's different.
Well, that's different, yeah. That's entertainment.
Yes, indeed.
I wanted to be involved in the community, and I saw an ad in the paper for looking for volunteers for Friends at Christmas, which was a lovely dinner that was put on by the various churches for about 200 people every year at Christmas time. And I worked with Winston Lehigh on that. And then once Winston decided to step aside, I took over and managed that for a few years. And while I was doing that, I was also involved on the board with the Shuswap Family Resource Center. I was a Rotarian as well, so I got involved with Rotary through people I met at Friends at Christmas. And, of course, they do a lot of very beneficial work in the community, and I'm still quite close to them, and they're very close to my heart. So I just kind of kept getting more and more involved with groups that were looking after community issues, people, projects, that kind of thing.
Just remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Valerie Semenyuk, who's the manager at Second Harvest. It sounds like this sort of progression of bringing the values that had been part of your life early on and remained part of your life when you were working in a formal environment that was not a formally helping. It was, these were businesses you were involved in, but nevertheless, you brought those same qualities to what you did there. And now you've kind of come to the point where, as you arrived in Salmon Arm and started to get formally involved in busy volunteer activities, it's sort of the final development of all these qualities you've been there for a long time.
I think I felt very comfortable in that role. I would take join something and look at it and figure out how it ran, and then would make suggestions or ask for comments as to how things might be done better or changed, or just sort of evolved into a particular pattern.
So you started with Friends for Christmas.
Yes.
And that, of course, would have helped you see how the community worked and see how the organizations in the community worked. With your attention to details, you would say, okay, these seem to be related to that, and that's related to this.
Yes. Hmm.
What was the next direction that you moved in terms of actual formal volunteer work?
Well, I had volunteered at Second Harvest probably 9.5 years ago. I was just a volunteer. And the Second Harvest and NeighborLink group are church-driven. They're driven by Christian organizations.
So you should talk a little bit about NeighborLink, because it's a significant body that sort of contains some of these other activities as well.
Mm-hmm. NeighborLink is our umbrella company. They are actually a registered charity, and we fall under their registration. NeighborLink is, again, Christian-driven, and we collect furniture throughout the community and then disperse it back to the community free. We have a lot of young people who don't live here but have retired family members here. And they come and they have a whole house full of furniture and items to get rid of, and they're not sure what to do. So they call us when parents go into care and say, will you come and take this away and just make it go away so we don't have to spend days here dealing with it. And we receive a lot of those calls. And we have all kinds of items, refrigerators, washers, dryers, stoves, bedding, Chesterfields, living room suites, bedroom suites, small appliances. And we work closely with other community members. We work with the Women's Transition Society, Safe Society, and help a number of their people transitioning into the community by helping them fill their homes with furniture.
So, Valerie, I'm imagining a large stack of household items coming into the possession of NeighborLink. What happens next? Where does this stuff go? I mean, obviously you've mentioned some groups where it goes to, but there's a lot of it, a lot of stuff.
There is. We have 4 40-foot vans filled with furniture. People who have lost their homes to fire or natural disaster will call us. Either through churches, our name is out there, or just generally other people who have used our services. And we're very busy. We did looked after 135 families last year, giving them furniture or just small items. If you have a senior who now needs a chair or a hospital bed that is more appropriately designed for their requirements, we do have those items as well. So we will take them a new chair or bed.
With the wildfire season this year that was pretty devastating for a
yes.
number of families, has that resulted in an uptick in the distribution of various things?
Not yet. We are ready, but I think people are still a little bit stunned and don't really know quite what they should do next. We see that in Second Harvest as well. Mm-hmm. We do have some evacuees coming in, but they're still trying to process everything that's happened, sort out where they go from here. And so furniture and that kind of thing are not sort of top of mind at this point.
Right. How do you let people know that there is an option for them to get these kinds of materials when they're ready?
We try to raise our profile because it's very quiet. Not a lot of people know about us, but through our Christian members and their churches, and I don't hesitate to take the opportunity when I'm asked to come and talk to people about Second Harvest to also throw in a plug for NeighborLink to try to increase their profile in the community as well.
We're definitely doing that today.
Yes, we are. Thank NeighborLink you.
NeighborLink is available. Everybody listening, NeighborLink is available. So Second Harvest you'd volunteered at this point.
Yes.
But you ended up becoming the manager. How did that happen? I can see how it happened. It was attention to detail, long business experience, knows how to organize things, works on team building, empowers members. What else do we need? I think we got it all right there.
Yeah. I was our church representative on the board. And when the previous manager decided to make a change, Diana Mangold, she's the manager over at Church's Thrift Store. So we were trying to decide what should we do because that was a paid position. And so I was asked, because I worked there, if I would kind of just follow Diana around and find out the details that the rest of the crew did not know because it was a different part of the program. So I did that, and then I was asked to make a recommendation to the board, and I felt that it should be a volunteer position, not a paid position.
And this is going back to the roots that we've already talked about.
Yes.
The roots of volunteers get rewarded by the experience of being a volunteer.
Exactly. So when I made that recommendation, little did I know that I would be the one doing the work. So we split the job into three positions, so that it would be about 12 hours per person a week working on all of the jobs, duties, and activities
that were going on. So altogether, it was pretty much a three-part full-time
job.
Yes,
yes. And of course, as the years went by, two of the other parts dropped off and went on to do other things or just retired. So then I took on the entire position. We are on all volunteer base. We have no paid employees. Our space is donated by the Salmar Theater. We have very, very low overhead. So we don't get government funding in any way or government food. You're only allowed to have one registered food bank with BC food banks, and that's the Salvation Army. So we've been in business in our current location for 30 years. It was originally started by Kay Braby, and then a number of other churches got involved, and it's still here and still growing. We have actually increased our numbers significantly over the years. We upgraded our store, spent more time talking to people, finding out what their needs were. Again, my sort of penchant for detail. Are we just giving them food, or are we giving them food that is good for them, that they want? Of course, a lot of people would just like to eat junk food, but we're very firm about...
On this show, we never discuss that.
We want to be able to provide nutritious, fresh food. So everything that we give out is fresh in terms of vegetables. We buy it all fresh to make sure that they're getting the best that we can give them. We offer them eggs, milk, meat, bread, canned groceries, and many, many other. Like, the summer is wonderful for us because groups like the Food Action Society, one of our community partners, grows their garden for us. And so they bring us hundreds and hundreds. Now it's at thousands of pounds of vegetables every week.
And what's unique about what you're doing is there's an awful lot of fresh fruit of what are called perishables.
Yes.
In your menu, if you want to call it that.
Yes.
I don't want to go any further until you tell listeners how, if for any reason they or someone they knew needed to access the services of Second Harvest, how would they do so?
We have a Facebook page, we have a website, and of course our telephone. Our number at the store is 250-833-4011. If you give us a call, we can find out what your needs are and organize to give you the information we have. Like most food banks, we don't have everything available every day. It's whatever we have available that will feed 200 people. So people can come down to the store any time between 10 and 6 on a Wednesday and just come in the doors, go through, see what we have available. And again, it's all fresh, potatoes, carrots, onions, vegetables, and salad now, items.
And now is your chance to give the address of the store so everybody knows where to go.
360B Alexander Avenue, and we actually are at the rear of the Selmore Theater, right? If you're standing in the Ross Street parking lot, we're on the lower level, left side of the Selmore Theater.
So you can see that big movie reel.
Yes, and to the left of that is a great big lime green awning with Second Harvest on it. And that's where people come in. We get a lot of people, too, who come at other times for whatever reason. We try to look after everyone. We never turn anyone away. We do not qualify people. We don't ask even for your full name. We just want your name, first name, so we know how many people come through. And that's all we require. We ask you to bring your own bags since we can't use plastics anymore. We do have paper bags, but we find that the amount of food we give out is a little bit heavy in a paper bag. So,
but I think, people, and you don't want to make more waste for people to have to discard either.
No. So we are open, as I say, from 10 till 6. It allows parents to drop children at school and then come or come before they pick them up at lunch if they're in kindergarten. We've tried to hit all areas of the day that people might be able to come. People who work can come after 4:30. And we're open until 6 o'clock, so we find that the afternoon around 4 o'clock can be quite busy. And our clientele is mainly seniors, working families, people with some disabilities, and we do have a few unhoused individuals who come through as well. And we tailor our giving to them on that basis. For people who are unhoused, we give them things that have zip tops, and we provide them with cutlery or even a can opener, things they can heat up over a fire or in a hot water, in a service station sink sort of thing. That's my level of detail, and that's where I delve into things. There's no sense giving somebody a can of something and they can't get into it. So,
or giving them food that they can't chew because they don't have any teeth.
Exactly. Yeah. So we do have a little bit different food selection for people who are unhoused and for seniors, but basically they're welcome to have whatever we have available. But we do try to make those items available.
I see your role of grandmother, this traditions of grandmotherliness, running through this whole process, because as a grandmother you pay attention to the details of your grandchildren and the circumstances of their living, but there's also an animating affection that's underlying everything you're doing. And transposing that to the population at large is sort of in some ways a natural step if you really value that role, if you really feel that it's part of who you are, and that's clearly what is the case. So there's a number of partners with Second Harvest that they interact with you in a variety of different ways. For example, Immigrant Services. What sort of connection do you have with them?
With Immigrant Services, we often get calls. During COVID, we had a particularly difficult call. A number of immigrant people who were picking cherries at an orchard could not get into town to get food because of COVID. And so we received a call from the immigrant worker who was working with these people. Could we help them? So we started to deliver food to them in the Scotch Creek area, and that was between 25 and 30, some Mexican individuals and some from the Bahamas. And so we tried to tailor the food we took them to their home-type foods.
Their
beans
reality.
Beans and rice and those kinds of things. Again, trying to be effective, not just throwing food at them, but trying to give them something that they would be used to, that they could cook. So we gave well, for several weeks, we were bringing about 2,500 pounds of food a week to the places that they were located. And that helped them until they went back to their home country.
As you're speaking, I could not help thinking that I hope there are some high-level policymakers listening to this show to hear the flexibility, adaptability, and responsiveness of Second Harvest, how as you, with your attention to detail and focus on what's actually happening as opposed to theories, have inculcated this notion that you do what you have to do for the community when it needs it. Continuing on the idea of what you were doing for this group of immigrants who were sort of stranded, there's a lot of pickups going on through the weeks and the months.
Yes.
Just describe the volume and the number of how that works, and the number of people who are working with Second Harvest as well.
We pick up between 75 and 92 pickups a month. That's from fast food operations, from the stores, Askew's, Save on Foods, Shoppers Drug Mart, No Frills.
And these are all firmly established relationships, right?
Yes.
These are regular pickups. They're not just spot pickups. They're
no, that's
ongoing.
Right. We have a schedule of every week so many pickups at Tim Hortons, Starbucks, and the other stores that I've mentioned. And so people will pick that up, bring it back to the store, prepare it, and then freeze it. Anything that is fresh, we freeze to ensure that it's properly cared for. We also have a crew that of about 40 people who work in the month doing distribution. We are open from 10 until 6, so we have two shifts of people each day from 10 till 2, and then from 2 till 6. So our previous Friday, Wednesday crews, when we were open 2 days a week, have now slid into a group doing Wednesday afternoon
shifts.
And one doing in the morning. So people seem very pleased with the change we've made. There's no lineups to get in. They're pleased that they can access the service eight full hours.
Is that because it's a long session on one day? They get to know which day it is. They don't have to remember.
Yes, and you know, when you're trying to hit a target that's there for an hour and a half to 2 hours, and you've got family things happening, work things happening, and sometimes that doesn't work. And so they get there and they can be somewhat stressed. And it's not, you know, it isn't great when you have to line up with 100 people.
Good Lord, no.
Yeah. So we made the decision the first part of September to change our hours to offer more time and a more relaxed and a more dignified opportunity for people to come to Second Harvest. Now they don't line up. They just come in, walk in the store, get what they need, and head back out. So a lot of them have indicated that that's a big plus. They like the not having to rush to get there. They like the fact that we call it the store. We downplay food bank. We don't want the stigma associated with a food bank. And so we're trying to give people some pride and you know, just feeling better about coming. A lot of people we found, especially during the fires, they didn't want to come. They had never been to a food bank, and so there's a real stigma around going to a food bank. People think a food bank is for people they see stumbling down the street with old clothes and, you know, whatever. And really, that's not true. The example here in Salmon Arm is people who grew up here, who own a home here, can no longer afford that home and food on top of it.
Yes,
many of our working families are people who have lived here all their lives, but the cost of living here and the cost of owning a home and a rental, if you can find one, is significant. So
I even heard from the director of the Salvation Army operation here that people who were at one point donating to a food bank as private citizens are now attending.
Yes.
Second Harvest and their food bank.
Yes,
because
that's right.
Their circumstances have changed.
You know, all of us are not very far away from being one of those people. A passing in the family of a spouse or a partner, passing in the family of a job, like the job is no longer there.
Two injuries.
People have no money coming in. They might be able to get assistance, but at the cost of food, the cost of fuel, and the cost of housing, they can't manage. They just can't.
Now, you've told me before we started the show that your faith, your spiritual beliefs are an important part of what you do and have been there throughout your whole life. And there are many people who call themselves Christians, but their behavior isn't necessarily what you would think Christian behavior was to be: kindness, acceptance of all, you know, love thy neighbor. But it seems to me that this way of living in the world, if you like, has been present in your life. You've seen it from when you were a child. You've seen it over the years. You've seen it in your workplace. And now you're seeing it in your volunteer work. And this notion of being kind and being kind to everybody. Why don't you, from your grandmother's perspective, talk about being kind to everybody?
Well, my personal life, I've been very, very fortunate. And I never really had a lot of hardship. I mean, every young couple, when they're getting started, it's difficult. But we were very fortunate in our lives. We worked hard and had some breaks that worked well for us. But that's not necessarily the case for everyone. Illnesses, disabilities, things happen in your life that you have no control over. And it's important that we be there to help one another. It's very difficult to go through trauma and difficult times in a family without some sort of assistance. Through my church, we do a lot to help people as well. And that just, to me, carries on into Second Harvest. We want to make sure that people who need help get help. We want to ensure that what we're doing is high value and that we are giving the very best foods that we can to them. And we also have a resource wall, we call it, in our store, where we have cards and information on all the other services and charitable services in town, BC Health and Interior Health and Interior Housing and so on. How do they connect with these people?
So you're a bit of a hub for information as well as services and food, actual food.
Yes.
When you look at the whole issue of food security and ultimately food sovereignty, in other words, the whole community can control its food supply so that the food they get is the kind of food they want rather than somebody else's idea in a faraway place. What is your sense overall of how things have been developing, say, since you came here, but also looking back over a lot of social changes that have taken place?
It's tough. It is tough for families. It is tough for individuals. My heart goes out to seniors because really they haven't had a lot of changes in their income. And to try and live here and purchase food, it's very difficult for the majority of them.
Would you say it's tougher now than, say, 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago? Have you seen a trend in
yes.
increasing difficulties for
yes.
people?
Yes, oh, for sure. Just generally, the cost of living is so much higher, and particularly here in Salmon Arm. Properties are very expensive, and, I mean, the availability is very, very low. We try to match people up with services that will introduce them to housing opportunities or rental opportunities, and we sort of say, if you find a place to live, we will be happy to feed you. That's our job. Mm-hmm. So we don't necessarily give them the entire amount of food, but we're a big supplemental part
sure.
of their purchases and the food that they need to eat and to feed their children.
And food is such a central issue in people's lives in terms of having the energy to accomplish tasks that you have to undertake, in terms of having a sense of well-being, in terms of having a sense that you know where your next meal is coming from. Second Harvest has been, for 30 years, doing the same thing, but increasingly in an increasingly sophisticated and flexible way. And with your attention to detail, keeping an eye on things, increasingly directed towards things that actually arise rather than something out of a manual. It seems to me that's a very important quality to have in what you're doing.
Yes, that's part of my nature, is to make it better, make it work better, make it be better, and to give people the opportunity to have what they need without having to feel bad about it or having to...
Without having to explain
exactly.
something that's so basic as food.
As food. And, we've seen our numbers increase significantly. We did, in the month of August, 275 families a week. That translates to feeding 2,200 people a month. That's a lot of people in a place the size of Salmon Arm. A lot of them are working families, unfortunately, but they just do not make enough money to be able to feed their children.
Do you find that, in general terms, people in the community are aware of this sort of vulnerable stratum in our community, or do they just kind of go about their lives?
I think there's a certain percentage of people that do. There's always going to be people who know nothing about any of that. They kind of live in their own bubble, and they're quite happy there, and that's fine. But I think we've worked really hard, we and the Salvation Army, to try to increase people's understanding of how many people we have coming through our doors and what the need is here. Not necessarily a need for people who aren't working or people who aren't housed. It's for everyone.
Before we end the show, tell us, listeners, about the pumpkin patch.
Oh, that's a great thing. A lot of our fundraising comes through various groups having fundraisers, and tomorrow, October 22nd, Nick Parsons and his family at the Green Acres Farm are having a pumpkin patch fundraiser. It will cost you a donation to get in to come and get a pumpkin. The timing is 10 till 4. The address is 1050 60th Street Southwest. I will be there along with others from Second Harvest. They're doing this fundraiser totally on behalf of Second Harvest. So I look forward to seeing everyone. Please come out and support us and learn a little bit more about Second Harvest.
And as far as your donation is concerned, size is no object. We will take any size.
We can write a receipt for $10.
You know, Valerie, it's been loving. I've been loving talking to you about the spirit that animates the role of grandmother in the world. I've mentioned it number of times in the show, but it's because I think it's something in our world we don't always fully understand. I would throw in aunties with grandmothers.
Yes.
But there's something special about the kind of warmth and the acceptance of children, especially grandchildren, that is a feature that gives you a whole different perspective on life. For one thing, it makes you realize that as you get old, you don't become marginalized, you actually become essential. Yes. And I think you've given our listeners an incredible vision of your own way of dealing with these issues, and I'm sure a lot of people will be much more knowledgeable about Second Harvest, but also about the values that underlie it and the values that underlie your life. We're very grateful to have had you on the show on Food Conversations.
Thank you so much for having me.
Delighted.